nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so today I'd like to continue our discussion of basis functions. And if you remember, what basically it involves is, one way to think about it is, it's a way to solve the Schrodinger equation, or any differential equation for that matter. Because, as I said, we finally want density of states, and that's what we'll be talking about for the next couple of weeks, actually. But the starting point for this is Schrodinger equation. And like earlier in the course, we talked about how you can solve the Schrodinger equation for a hydrogen atom, and actually for any atom for that matter, because what simplifies that those problems is that because of the spherical symmetry, you can reduce it to a one-dimensional problem. And then we had this finite difference method by with which you could write H. You could turn this operator into a matrix, and this matrix could be written as this 2, 2, etc., minus 1, minus 1, this 1, etc., the upper diagonal and the lower diagonal. And so first you set up a discrete lattice. So just draw this here. Set up a discrete lattice like so. And then the elements of this column vector here represent the value of the function at different points on this lattice. And you have this matrix whose elements you write down, and then you can use MATLAB or all the powerful subroutines for solving matrix eigenvalues, eigenvectors that we have talked about. Now, a more general method that's widely used is this concept of basis functions. And that is that this function that you want to find, you express it as a linear combination of a known set of functions. So these basis functions are not something you're trying to find from somewhere. It's like, for some reason, you want to use a particular set. For some reason, meaning some based on your knowledge of the problem, you think that this particular set would work well. So you're using that particular set of functions. And one common example you may have seen before is the Fourier series. So in some cases, Fourier series is a nice set of basis functions to use. But it's much more, the concept is much more general than that, not just Fourier series. There's all kinds of functions. And once you have expressed it in this way, these are numbers. And when you arrange them along a column, that becomes the column vector. And this differential equation becomes a matrix equation looking like this. And you have a matrix S here and a matrix H here. And the elements of these matrices are given by these integrals. So if you want the elements of S, you have to do this integral. If you want the elements of H, that's the integral you have to do. And as I said, in practical problems where you're actually trying to determine this matrix from first principles, major part of the time spent is actually in computing these integrals. Like I mentioned last time, a very popular program called the Gaussian program, where these are Gaussian functions. And people have to do these integrals, and Gaussian is chosen because there are particularly powerful ways of obtaining the integrals. But the thing is, once you have found the integrals, you have these matrices, and once you have the matrix, you can go ahead like before. And this is a much more general method. Now, of course, you could have approached the problem just by setting up a lattice like before. It's just that in that case, you'd in general have ended up with a far bigger matrix. Here, the real advantage is that if you choose your basis functions wisely, wisely meaning based on your knowledge of what you're looking for, then you could often get by with fewer basis functions, and what that means is far smaller matrices. So the example I took was like the hydrogen molecule, two hydrogen atoms. Now, in general, as I said, if you just set up the matrix with a discrete lattice, you'd end up with probably like 100 points along this way. And since it's a three-dimensional problem, that would end up with like a million points, like I discussed. What that means is the matrices could easily be a million by million. On the other hand, if you use the idea that, well, given if this hydrogen atom were by itself, then the lowest level would have been this one S level, whose wave function I know. In the sense that hydrogen atom, these are things we know how to solve because atoms, as I've mentioned, have been solved quite accurately, just directly, and these are all known. So for hydrogen by itself, I know what it is. For this hydrogen by itself, I know what it is. And so when I'm trying to write, when I'm trying to find the eigenfunctions of a hydrogen molecule, I use the ansatz that what I'm trying to find, I say, is a linear combination of this and that. It's U is phi 1 times this plus phi 2 times that. And to the extent this ansatz is accurate, you see, the thing is, with just a 2x2 matrix, I'll get pretty good results. But of course, if I had chosen some other functions which had nothing to do with what I'm looking for, then I'd still have a 2x2 matrix, but the results would have been all wrong. The reason this works very well is because this is a pretty good guess to start with. What really happens in this case is something like this. And you might say, well, what about all the other ones? Like, you know, the hydrogen atom by itself, we know that there's one S, but then up here there's this two S, and then there are the three P levels. You see, there's two P, X, Y, and Z. So there's actually four levels out there. So there's four levels out there, actually. So when I'm choosing my basis functions, I chose just this one and this one, but there's no obvious reason why I shouldn't include these as well. Now, if I want to include these, then I had a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'd have it would be a 10 by 10 matrix if I had done that, right? Now, the thing is that as long as I'm looking for energy levels in this range, you see, with two of these, as we discussed last time, you get one bonding level and one anti-bonding level, one a little higher, one a little lower. And as long as these are relatively far from this in energy, usually what would happen is with just these two, you'd get pretty good results. If you include those, there would be minor corrections, but with just these two, the results would be reasonably accurate. And then, of course, if you adopt the semi-empirical approach where you adjust your parameters a little bit to actually match experiments, then they can be as accurate as you want almost in that context. So that's what people usually do. So there are first principles methods where you start from first principles and use things like this. And then, of course, the more basis functions you use, the better the results get. So if you use just these two, you'll get one level of results. You include that and include some more, it will get better. And how much better depends again on what you're including and, you know, how judiciously you choose them based on various information. So on the other hand, if you're doing a semi-empirical approach, you say, okay, I'll just work with a 2x2 matrix and I'll adjust the elements of this matrix, which I know from symmetry should look like AA, BB. You know, it's a hydrogen molecule, so no reason why this should be any different from that. Left and right are same. Those two should be the same. And so I've got two parameters to adjust, and I'll adjust those two to match the kind of experiments I'm interested in. I'll get some information on where those levels are, adjust them accordingly, and then get on with this, use this matrix for other stuff, like to calculate current or to do other things with it. So that would be the semi-empirical approach to things. Get these matrix elements by fitting a certain set of data. Okay? Now, one example that I wanted to go through quickly today, where actually you can do things using this approach and get useful results. And it also shows you why, if you are interested in energy levels around here, let's say, for example, then you could get good results by just using these instead of these. So as your basis functions, if you use these, you could get good results if you're interested in the levels around here. If you're interested in the levels around here, then you should use these. And for R, I'll try to show you an example where you'll kind of see why that happens. We'll talk about that a little bit. And the point is then that with any solid, when we're trying to figure out what should be our basis functions, what matrix should we use, the approach is that, let's say, you know, real solid, like say silicon, crystalline silicon, looks something like this. You know, you have these, actually for silicon, the elemental semiconductors, the black and white, the black and yellow atoms are the same. They're both silicon. Whereas if it was a compound semiconductor, one would be gallium, the other would be arsenic. But basically, this is what you call the diamond structure. So silicon is all arranged this way. So if I'm trying to find the eigenfunctions in this material, my first thing is, what basis functions should I use? What I'm trying to do is turn that into a matrix. And that matrix I'm going to write down with some basis functions. And so what basis functions should I use? Well, one approach is take the atomic orbitals on each silicon. So which atomic orbitals? Well, silicon has an atomic number of 14. And those 14 electrons, you know, that number, of course, tells you the number of electrons. That 14 comes from, there's two electrons in 1s. And then there's the 2s2p6. This second shell is all filled. And there's 6 and 2, 8 and 2, 10. And then there's 4 left over. And that's in the valence shell. Sp, this. Overall 4 here. I'll write 2 and 2, but it's kind of overall there. 4 of them. Okay. So which is called the, which are the valence electrons then? Is this one, the uppermost one. This is the one. So if I were drawing it here, you would have things like this 3p, and then there would be stuff here. For example. So, if I were doing a theory of silicon, I could have chosen as my basis functions all of these. So, 1, 4, and 4. So, then there would be 9 of them per atom. But if I'm interested only in the electrons in this energy range, then usually I could get fairly good results with just these 4, just the valence ones. And so there are both types of theories. There are, you know, some first principles theories where you include everything. Matrix gets bigger. And then there are the more simpler ones, where you, especially the semi-empirical ones, where you use these 4 and adjust parameters to get it right, whatever it is. So those are the 4 you'd use. So, in fact, there are some where they say, rather than include this, you're much better off if you include the 3D. Because the 3D isn't too far higher either. And so they kind of mix with this a lot in that sense, and when you have a solid. So sometimes people would include not just these 4, but 4 and some, you know, the D ones, which are like 5 of them. That's it. Okay. So finally, when you write down the matrix, so the simplest theories would have about 4 basis functions per atom, 4 of those. And so if there are n atoms, this matrix that you write down eventually will end up being, what would be the size of the matrix? If you're using 4 basis functions per atom, and you got capital N number of atoms. 4n by 4n. That's what it would be. Yes.
And the 3p orbitals are in higher energy than 2s, 3D in general.
In an atom by itself, that would be the case. In an atom, just an atom. So in hydrogen atom, it's an analytical result, as you know. In any other atom, as I said, can be solved quite exactly, quite well for any other atom. And when the difference between hydrogen atom and other atoms is that in hydrogen atom, these four have the same energy. In any other atom, the P's are a little above S. Same here, P's are above S. So for atoms, those are quite well established and known, right?
But in general, if you have a 3D, 4D, all of them are going up or not.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, I think after some orbital, some of them start to mix.
Right, right. So this is where things get a little mixed up as you go higher, in the sense that, you know, I said about 3D, but then 4S is also in that same range, you see? And so, the simplest theories of these atoms would include SP3. That's the S and the three P's. That's what you would use as your basis functions per atom. And then there are some theories which include the 4S. So it's like S, P3, and another S. So this is the 3S and that's the 4S. So people usually put a star there. So then they say SP3S star models. And then there would be models where they would use SP3S star D models, which would have the 3D in it. Or maybe they drop the star and just use the D. Because finally, again, these are all semi-empirical approaches, because after you have generated a matrix structure, the elements you are not really getting honestly from here, you are getting it by fitting a certain set of experiments. And the question is, which one gets you better results with the fewest parameters?
For silicon, it's clear.
Yeah, I've seen models of all types. SP3, the simplest ones, SP3S star. People say you need this to get the conduction band better. Then I've seen SP3Ds. And people who do use one of them, of course, think that one is the best. And then they would have, you know, arguments about which is better and so on. Right. Okay. So the matrix then would be 4n by 4n. And ordinarily, of course, we are talking about n's that are huge. We're talking of solids with thousands of atoms in it. And so if we directly try to find the eigenvalues of this, that's not very easy either. I mean, straightforward, but takes time on a computer and so on. But the interesting thing, and that's what we'll be doing for the next week or two actually, is that if your solid is periodic, in the sense that all atoms are arranged in a particular periodic fashion like this, you know, not amorphous, but have a certain regularity to it, then you can write down the eigenvalues of this matrix analytically. That's the thing. Without actually having to go to a computer. Now, if it was all amorphous, there's no simple way out of it. But if it is periodic, and that's the principle of band structure, that's what we'll be talking about in the next few lectures, actually. That's what it'll be. I'll try to explain how, by making use of that periodicity, you can actually write down the eigenvalues analytically. Okay. Now, but today what I wanted to explain a little more about is how you choose the basis functions in a particular problem, and then how big is the matrix we are talking about in general. So in general then, the size of the matrix is number of atoms and then number of basis functions per atom. And how many basis functions do you have per atom? Well, basically you want to use, if you're using the atomic basis functions, then you kind of want to use all those that are in the range of energies that you're interested in. That's like the minimum you want. In other words, if you just keep the S ordinarily and don't keep the P's, that won't be right. Because those are all would contribute about equally. So you want to keep those. On the other hand, you might ignore all the core, these ones. But remember that these are just basis functions. It's not like they're eigenfunctions of your solid at all. These are just basis functions that you're using to expand what it is you are trying to find. They just happen to be eigenfunctions of an individual atom, not in the solid. In the solid, it's some linear combination, you have to find what it is. Okay. Now, one interesting example is carbon. Or let me come back to it. Let me just first go through this example that I mentioned, which is that I want to go through this example to illustrate why, if you are interested in the energy levels around here, you can often get good results without including, say, something that's far away here. Okay? Let me just go through that example quickly, and then we'll get on to the real problems you're interested in, like carbon, silicon, all that stuff. Okay. So this particular problem I want to show you is the following, and this is the advantage of being, again, something that's exactly soluble. And we're trying to find approximate ways of seeing the answer. And it goes something like this. It's not even a hydrogen molecule. We are talking about a hydrogen atom. So hydrogen atom, as you know, you have a 1s level, 2s, 2p, etc. And you can write them all down. And all the actual eigenfunctions for each one, they're all known. You can look it up anywhere. So, okay. Now, what we want to know is, how would these energy levels change if I put an electric field? So in other words, if this hydrogen atom were sitting between like two capacitor plates with an electric field in some direction, some electric field F. Well, what that means is you'd have to go back to Schrodinger equation and solve it all over again. Solve it all over again because now, in addition to your potential you had before, you have to add a new potential which corresponds to the electric field. Because in an electric field, the potential changes by Q times F times Z, if your electric field is in the Z direction. And F is the field. You know, you often use E for field. I didn't do that because we are using E for energy. So I'm saying let's call it F. And then Q is the charge on an electron. So if F is the field, then Fz is like the potential. And then you have a QFz. And whether it's plus or minus, you know, that depends on the direction of the field. So whatever that is. Okay, now the question is, what are the energy levels in the presence of a field? And what I wanted to show you is that this is one case where you could have just gone to your computer, put that in. You know, once you have set up a program to solve the hydrogen atom, it's easy to add a potential like this. You could have done that. But if you use this idea of basis functions, you can actually get answers much faster. I mean, you can get answers just on paper without going to a computer. And of course, this computer method, as you know, like 30, 40 years ago wasn't at all available, now has become very convenient. Like on a laptop, you can easily do a problem of this size. But it wasn't this convenient even 20 years ago. Now, the way you'd go about it then, in a problem like this, is you could say, let's use these as our basis functions. 1s, 2s, 2px, 2py, and 2pz. What I'm trying to do is write down this H matrix using the eigenstates of the hydrogen atom as my basis functions. 1s, 2s, 2px, 2py, 2pz, etc. Okay? Those are the eigenstates. And, of course, the Schrodinger equation now looks like H is whatever it was for the hydrogen atom, but now you have added the field to it. That term's always there. Okay. So let's first try to write down what this matrix would look like if we did not have the field. Because these things are linear. If I can write down the matrix for this, and I can write down the matrix for that, I can then just add them up. So let's first try to write down the matrix just for a hydrogen atom. Well, my question is, do you see what that would look like? How would you find it? Well, you'd have to do something like this. Right? The basic principle is this. Now, the reason this is very easy is that all these functions are actually all eigenfunctions of this H operator. Right? So supposing, let's say I'm trying to find this one. So UM is just the one S function. You know, whatever that function is. This is also the one S function. Now, what is H operator acting on one S? Well, it's the energy of the one S level times one S. Because this is an eigenfunction of H as it stands. Because remember, we are talking about the hydrogen atom eigenfunctions. And so far, this H operator is just the hydrogen atom part of it. So what we know is that H operator, I think I can take this off, write this here. H operator acting on this one S function. Now I'll call this U1S, so you know what we mean. Now that's this basis function U, that's the one S one. And that's equal to, let's say, E0 times U1S. Or I guess this is the one level, I'll call it E1. So the point is, this can be written as E1 times U1S. And this guy is just U1S. So can you tell me what this integral will be? Just E1. Because this E1, this number, I can pull out of the integral. And then what I'm left with is integral U1S, U1S. And these functions are all normalized usually, the basis function we're using, which means that when you multiply them, integrate over a volume, it's 1, let's say. So the thing is, this will be E1. Now, if you went to the 2S, what would be the answer? Can you help me with that? Write this a little lower so it doesn't get in the way. Yeah, go ahead. Can you help me with what will be the 2S thing? Well, if I use a 2S here, this will be E2. That's the second level. Like, this one is like minus 13.6 electron volts. This one is like minus 13.6 divided by 2 square. That's 4. 13.6 divided by 4, whatever that is. So that's the E2. But then same story. What about this one? E2, same. Because 2px, all these levels have the same energy in a hydrogen atom. Same here. Now, right, no fields yet. I'm just trying to write down the matrix for the hydrogen atom sitting by itself. Right? Now, any thoughts on what this one is, let's say? Well, you could say, now what would happen is, let's say this is U2S. So H operator acting on that is E2 times U2S. And you could pull out the E2, so you'd have integral over all volume U1S times U2S. That's like this integral, essentially. Now, the thing is that all the eigenfunctions of, since these are all the eigenfunctions of a hydrogen atom, they are all orthogonal, those functions, which means they have this property. This is what's called orthogonal functions, that this integral is equal to 0 if n is not equal to m, and is 1 if n is equal to m. That's all. Now, this is not true in general. Like the last day, we went through an example where we had a hydrogen molecule, and our two basis functions look like this. And those two are not orthogonal by any means, because this is the eigenfunctions of one hydrogen atom here. That's the eigenfunction of another hydrogen atom there. And there's no reason why they should be orthogonal. On the other hand, if you consider the eigenfunctions of the same hydrogen atom, 1s, 2s, 2p, etc., then they have the property that, yeah, they have this orthogonality property. It will be 0, 1, and this is often written as something called the Kronecker delta, delta nm. I mean, that's just a symbol which basically means this. That's all. So that's just a way of writing that. Yeah. Why we have this property? Okay. The simplest thing I can say is, yeah, that's a very good question, yeah, is that this hydrogen atom, if I was trying to solve for these functions, what I'd have done is, we'd have first written an operator, a matrix, let's say, for the hydrogen atom, and we would have found its eigenvectors equals, say, E times an eigenvector. So you'd have, so how would you have found these 1s, 2s, 2p, etc.? Well, in some basis functions, we could have written down H, found its eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And this H for this operator will always be Hermitian. That's something I'm just stating without proof, and that the kind of matrix you'll get for the operators that will appear in Schrodinger equation. This is not generally true for all operators, but for the operators that you are valid operators, you'll see in the Schrodinger equation, that matrix will be Hermitian. And Hermitian means that HNM is equal to HMN star. And if this is true, as long as you're dealing with the Hermitian matrix, then in this, when you have probably taken a course in linear algebra somewhere back, and you can, that's the part I'm kind of glossing over, because I'm assuming you have seen it somewhere, and you can dig up, is that for Hermitian operators, the eigenvectors are orthogonal. Whenever you find our eigenvectors corresponding to distinct eigenvalues, they will always be orthogonal. And if they are not distinct eigenvalues, then you can always choose them to be orthogonal. So this is the part I'm kind of drawing from linear algebra that you have hopefully seen somewhere before. Okay? Because to do justice to that is kind of a separate lecture by itself. That's the part I'm not doing. Okay. So here, then, the point is that because the basis functions we are using are the eigenfunctions of a hydrogen atom, they're all eigenfunctions of a particular Hermitian operator, so they are all orthogonal. And when you use them as your basis, what you can see easily is that the Hamiltonian matrix, that's what this matrix is called, H, looks diagonal. And the diagonal elements are the eigenvalues, E1, E2, 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 E2. Those diagonals are the eigen. And everything else is 0. And of course, you immediately see that if I take this matrix and find its eigenvalues, what are the eigenvalues of this matrix? Anytime you have a diagonal matrix, the eigenvalues are just this, 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 and this. Which makes sense. I mean, those are the eigenvalues. You should be getting them. No reason why you shouldn't. And what are the eigenvectors? Well, the eigenvector corresponding to this one will actually look like 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Which, if you were to substitute it back in here, you'd say that the function I'm looking for is 1 times 1s plus 0 times 2s plus 0 times 2px, etc. Which tells you that the eigenfunction corresponding to this is 1s. But the eigenvector that MATLAB would give you, if you gave it that matrix, would look like 1, 0, 0, 0. If you looked at the eigenvector corresponding to that one, it would look like, can you help me? 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. Because it's a purely a 2s, etc. Okay. So that's it. So this then would be one way then of solving the hydrogen atom problem, if you, of course, knew the answer to start with. I mean, that's not a very useful thing to do, but at least it agrees with what you expect. Now, the problem we really want to do is QF. What happens when there's a field there? Okay. And the point is that when you put a field there, I'm trying to find the matrix corresponding to that. And the matrix corresponding to that will be largely zeros, except for a few elements. And those few elements are the following. This one, and I believe this one, and this one. I think those are the only ones that will be non-zero. Everything else will be zero. Actually. So when you work out the matrix elements for QFZ, and how would you work them out? Well, again, using this same principle. Exactly here, except that now for H operator, you put QFZ. And then you put whatever U you have, and whatever you have, do that integral. And when you have done that integral, at the end of the day, you'll find some number here. I'll call it A. And that would be the same. And some number here, which I'll call B. And that will be the same. Right. Why those are non-zero and why everything else is zero. Right. Very good question, of course. Yes.
Because the field is in the z direction. So it's like we are forcing the electrons from to interact from like 1s to 2pz and 2s to 2pz. It's because of that. I mean, so we have some sort of...
Well, what I'd say is, again, it's a result that follows from here, right? So that interaction issue then is something that you could try to get from here. I'm not sure I'd use those words, but bottom line is that if you didn't know anything about it and just blindly calculated this integral and did it right, you would have found those two with one value, those two with another non-zero value, and everything else would be zero. Question is there a simple reason for it? Now, the simple reason goes something like this. It has to do with the symmetry of these functions. And that is, okay, let's try, say, something here and something here. So 1s and 2s. Now, what happens is this. See, when I'm doing this integral, this dr, that, of course, means dx, dy, dz. Now, the S-type functions are all completely symmetric in x, y, and z. In a sense, if you go from x to minus x, it is exactly the same function. So, this is a function that is completely symmetric in x, symmetric in y, and symmetric in z. Now, this is a function which is also symmetric in x, symmetric in y, and symmetric in z. And here you have a function which is symmetric in x, because it doesn't depend on x, symmetric in y, but it is anti-symmetric in z. So the point is that when you do this integral, when you do the integral dx, dy, no problem. But as soon as you try to do the integral dz, since you're running from minus infinity to plus infinity, and overall this function is anti-symmetric, in the sense that anything you have at plus z, the whole thing minus z is exactly the negative of that. So when you integrate it all, every plus z point will cancel what you get from the minus z point. And so this will all end up being zero, because it's anti-symmetric there. Anti-symmetric because the field potential due to the field is anti-symmetric. Okay. Now, why didn't that argument work for 2pz? Why is it that when I come here, I get something? Well, that's because when I try to write the 2pz function, it has the property that it's symmetric in x, symmetric in y, but it is anti-symmetric in z. So it has to do with the symmetry of the functions, that the pz wave function is anti-symmetric in z. So now when I look at it, you see, x is all symmetric functions, so it's symmetric, y all symmetric, z, there are two things which are anti-symmetric, so when I multiply them, it's symmetric. Because there are two things which change plus minus. So when I look at the product, it's the same plus z and minus z. And so overall, I have a symmetric integrand, and when I multiply it out, I'll get something. And that same argument works for 2s and 2pz, just as it works for 1s and 2pz. But for anything else, you'd find it would be anti-symmetric in at least one, if not two, coordinates. And that is why it. So that's basically the physical reason, if you call it, of why those integrals end up being zero or non-zero, etc. So often you see when people are trying to write down these matrices, you can often use the symmetry properties of your basis functions to save a lot of work. But these are very clever arguments that have to be done rightly, and in order to be sure you're doing the right thing. Okay. Anyway, so in this context then, though, the main thing I wanted to illustrate is that this is how you could have written down the matrix. And here, of course, I've made no approximations in a way, apart from ignoring all the other things, in the sense that I took 1s, 2s, 2px, 2py, 2pz. I could have written 3s, 3px, all that stuff, and written a big matrix, but I left all the others out. It just stuck to this. Okay. Now, what if I had looked at just this much? Let's say I don't worry about the 1s. I say I'll just work with 2s, 2px, 2py, and 2pz. Just four. Now, can you tell me what will be the eigenvalues of this matrix? Now, it's a 4 by 4. In general, of course, 2 by 2, we should all be able to do anytime on paper. Anything bigger than that, you're better off using MATLAB. That will be faster. Although this is 4 by 4, what I claim is I can just do it on paper. Why is that? Well, that's because, you see, these two are the only off-diagonal elements. So if I were to write this same matrix by reorganizing it a little bit, let's say, then you'd see clearly what would happen. Of course, when writing matrices, there's no reason why you have to arrange things in a particular order. You can always switch them around, arrange them in whatever way you like. And the point is, if you did it this way, you'd find E2, B, B, E2, E2, E2. So this is what you'd call a block diagonal matrix. Block diagonal in the sense that this is one matrix, This is one. This is one. These are kind of the blocks. This is one block. This is one block. This is one block. And when you have a situation like this, and you want to find the eigenvalues of this 4 by 4, you can one eigenvalue will be E2, another will be E2, and the other two you find by finding the eigenvalues of a 2 by 2. And 2 by 2, of course, we all know, we should know how to do. So what are the eigenvalues of this 2 by 2? This is one thing I mentioned last day, that when these two are equal, and those two are equal, then it's just E2 plus P and E2 minus P. So, in this simple approximation, you know, where we have just used that thing, in a hydrogen atom, all four have exactly the same energy. When you put it in electric field, what will happen is, two of them will continue at the same energy as I turn up the electric field. So, let us say I'm gradually turning up the electric field. So, two of them will stay at the same place. One will go higher, one will go lower. Gradually. It'll gradually keep going up like this. And this is actually, again, in the early days of atomic physics, this was one of the experiments that was done. I mean, it's called the Stark shift in hydrogen atom. People measured it, and you could understand it very well in terms of what I just described to you. That, you know, people measured this shift, and basically you're getting pretty good answers here just by doing this. Now, you might say, well, wouldn't the answers change a lot if I include that? If instead of doing a 4 by 4, I'd done a 5 by 5, because then this one would get involved. And the answer is, for low fields, not really. Doesn't affect things much. Why? Because those two are very different. What you can check easily is that if you have two diagonal values that are equal, then when you put even the smallest number here, the eigenvalues, you know, the E2 and E2, they both, one goes up, one goes down. That we have discussed. Now, what if this was very different from that? Like, this was like 10 volts away. Then what would have happened is, if you have two things like this, then what you can show is, when you turn on an off-diagonal element, this just goes up a little bit, this just goes down a little bit. Not a whole lot. Just very small, at least for small values of B. The effect will become significant only when this B is comparable to the energy difference between them. So here you see E1 and E2 differ by like 10 volts. So the presence of this A has a relatively small effect as long as the field is not too large. Of course, once the field gets so large that, you know, this energy level essentially comes within the range of the 1S, this gets comparable to 1S, then it is important to include the A. Otherwise, you won't get good results. Okay? But as long as the fields are small enough that this is far away from this, it doesn't matter. So I kind of wanted to use this example for a number of reasons. One is that it's kind of an exact example where you can calculate results that agree quite well with what you'd have got if you had just solved Schrodinger equation directly. But the other point I wanted to make here is that why, if you're interested in energy levels around here, you can often get good answers without including this or something higher up. Why you can just use these as your basis functions and get fairly good answers. Okay? That this is a good kind of example that gives you a feeling for why that's true. Now, next day we'll go on and talk about how one calculates the energy levels in real solids. And basically it involves, again, assuming a set of basis functions, trying to write down the matrix, and then finding eigenvalues. And there, as I said, in general, you'd have a huge matrix to solve because most solids have thousands, if not millions, of atoms. But because of the periodicity of things, you can often write them down analytically. And that's the principle we'll be talking about for the next few lectures.